For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so I am a home church leader here in Zenos, and welcome again. I think it's been said, but those of you who are here from out of town or whatever, really super glad that you're here, and it's kind of cool that we get to host and hopefully be a part of God advancing his kingdom in a bigger way. So thanks for coming. So, yes, the topic for this breakout session is preserving the unity in your community. If you were here Wednesday night, you heard Jim Leffel speaking, and one of the things that he said was, when it comes to community or the close relationships that we can have with one another, he said, he called that, using Schaefer's term, the final apologetic. And by that, what he meant was that it's the quality and the consistency, the lastingness of the relationships that we have with one another, that is to be sort of like a major line of evidence for the watching world, right? Schaefer went so far as to say, if the world looks on and doesn't see close, lasting relationships, then they have every right to just conclude that this whole thing about Jesus is not true. And I know for me, as a very cynical, super cynical 20-year-old, it was seeing love relationships lived out in front of me that really stopped me to think maybe this stuff about Jesus is true. So what's at stake when it comes to, the love relationships that we have in our community, the stakes are very, very high. But more, I don't know if it's more than that, but in addition to that, these lasting, deep, loving relationships, this is one of the precious things that God gives us. When we receive Christ, it's like, it's great. We realize we've been forgiven once for all. Our eternal destiny has been set, But then we come to find out that in addition, he gives us the capacity to really have loving, lasting relationships. And it's a precious thing. I contend that the whole popularity with social media is it's driven by this. People are longing to have close, lasting relationships, right? It's because they've been designed that way. So this is what they're looking for. And yet God says, this is a birthright. If you're mine now, this is a birthright. And so preserving that unity is going to be a really important thing and something we don't want to take for granted. Paul, I think most of us know Paul in Ephesians 4. He says there that we should actually be diligent to preserve the unity. That means intentional, focused on this, right? And I think maybe a starting point in doing that is just to think again about the truth, the very sobering truth that we have an enemy and he is formidable. That God's enemy, Satan, stands against God and he stands against God's people. And you can bet that he stands against and he is looking for every opportunity to destroy and just derail Christian community. It's first and foremost in his mind. And to that end, did anybody get to hear Ryan Weingartner's breakout session yesterday on this? Wasn't it great? If you don't get a chance, I think he's doing it this afternoon, to hear this, listen to it when it's available. It's Satan is on your leadership team. And the title kind of says it all. He's present, right? And he has a vested interest of showing up. And his vested interest is to derail the unity in your group. And he'll go to any lengths to do that, right? Remember what Jesus said, that Satan's goal is to steal, to kill, and destroy. And since that's the case, again, it's going to be on us to be vigilant when it comes to his tactics. Paul kind of reminded the Corinthians in terms of their unity. He said, so that no advantage would be taken of us by Satan, for we are not ignorant of his schemes. Reminding him, look, don't be ignorant of how he operates, because if you do, then he will take advantage of you. So we don't want to be ignorant of his schemes. So, all right, if that's true, then we need to think through for a minute, what is his go-to tactic? How does he most often operate? And again, you think, okay, he's got these dramatic ways. Demon possession, it's real. It certainly does damage. Probably some of you have experienced, or close people who have experienced really intense, situations where they know they were being oppressed by the evil one. That's a tactic that he can use. Probably many of us know people who have been, basically have lost their walk with Christ, being swept away by all that the world system has to offer. That's a tactic as well. And I think he uses those. But I would argue that his go-to tactic time and time again is going to be division. It's going to be to divide, to divide. What is more common than husbands and wives not getting along and falling apart, families falling apart, Bible studies, churches, right? He is always on the prowl, and he's always ready to take advantage of dividing people. If he is able to plant a seed of alienation in our groups, then he has succeeded. And I'm here to say, and I mean this, you know, I don't mean to be brash or whatever, but some of us right here this morning are sitting here, and a year from now, the groups that we are currently in will no longer exist. You know, that can and most likely will happen to some of us. And I would argue that the reason that will happen is because of this very reason. The devil has been able to take advantage of and to plant seeds of division. So it's real sobering. So I have three ways that we can stand against him. And that's going to be engaging the battle in our thought life. It's going to be practicing forbearance with each other. And it's going to be to humble ourselves. And I just want to suggest that you kind of keep your heart sensitive to maybe one of these that God's laying on your heart in specific, because there's just a lot. Wouldn't it be amazing to come to one of these breakout sessions, I was thinking this, and have the speaker say, "You're probably going to be disappointed this morning. I hardly have any content, you know." So once again, there's way too much content, but just be sensitive to the one thing that God really wants to put on your heart. And they sort of bleed over into one another as well, as you'll see. All right. So engaging the battle in our thought life. Yes, as we've already talked about, we have an enemy on the outside, Satan. He's a roaring lion, you know, seeking to devour, right? But in addition, we have an enemy within, which is our flesh, right? And I want to argue this morning that our flesh is a force that we're up against that I think we all too often don't take very seriously, especially in regards to this issue of unity and our thought life. We pay too little attention to it. So let's look at that list that Paul lays out of how the flesh manifests itself. He says the acts of the flesh are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, and envy, drunkenness, orgies, and the like. I warn you, as I did before, that those who live like this will not inherit the kingdom of God. It's not a pretty picture he's painting here, right? Especially you think of these like really overtly awful things like sexual immorality, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, fits of rage, drunkenness. You're like, yikes. You know, that stuff is bad. But I want to argue that these other acts of the flesh, right, like hatred, discord, jealousy, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, and envy, these things have a tendency to fly under the radar, to not have a whole lot, for us to not give them a whole lot of attention, right? And these are the things that move us in the direction of alienation and ultimately division. So these things are very, very dangerous. And my hope this morning is that we're going to take this a whole lot more seriously than maybe when we came in here. So when it comes to the flesh, here's what I have found in my own life. That the flesh is alive and well, but not only that, that it's eager to make instantaneous alliances with the devil in this regard. So what do I mean? I mean, like, when that thought pops into my head about that person in my group, right? So I'm thinking, you know, dang, that person is so self-promoting, you know? And as I think about this, I let it kind of sit there and just kind of cogitate there. You know, then I kind of drift into, you know, and I can think of I can think of example after example that really kind of proves that, yeah, they are self-promoting. It always, you know, it's never something that's crazy and doesn't fit who they are, but it always fits something that's true about them. Otherwise, the thought, it wouldn't have any traction in our minds, right? So, yeah, it fits who they are, sure enough. But here's the thing. It's not only does it pop into my mind, I'm matching it up with what I've seen in their behavior. Yeah, I can remember last week in my ladies' Bible study, you know, not only did she tell that outrageous story, but sure enough, she was the hero of the story in the end, right? And I'm thinking about that, but there's something inside of me that kind of finds delight in that. And I'm like, yeah, on the inside, yeah. You know, and I'm not like that at all, you know? And I just find that there's this instantaneous alliance between my heart and what the devil wants to do. And here's the thing, I've realized that when that happens, that's a critical moment. And that at that moment, we need to wage war if we're going to preserve the unity. You know, and I think that what it amounts to is us taking every thought captive. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10, we're destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. I think we're used to applying this verse when it comes to matters of apologetics, say. I think we're used to applying this verse when it comes to matters of temptation, maybe. But I want to argue that when it comes to these negative thoughts that we have about brothers and sisters in our community, I think that oftentimes flies under the radar. And we need to decide, man, at this moment, I'm at a critical juncture here. I need to take this thought captive. And again, I want to argue that we need to wage war. Question is, will we turn away from that thought or not? In that moment, will I learn to say, Lord, help me here. Help me. Help me to not just remember and to think about what's true about this person, but also what's lovely about them. Help me to remember the good things that they bring to our group. Maybe it means me turning to pray for that person, maybe in a specific area where I'm focused on, right? But to stop myself and to take myself in hand, as it were, and to deal with that negative thought before it just continues to spin, right? So again, Paul, he talks about making no provision for the flesh. He says, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regards to its lust. And I'm saying, I think that there's a place for that here when it comes to our thought lives and one another. Again, you're here. Maybe you're pushing the very fearful age of 30. I don't know, you know. And maybe you're watching your friends get married, you know, and you've got that nagging thought. What about me? What's going to happen to me? Am I ever going to find a godly guy or a godly girl, right? And you're like, I wonder what my future holds. And then the thought pops into your mind, yeah, I do wonder about that. Maybe I should just stop in and see the fortune teller who signs on 161. What could that hurt? And you're like, nah, right at that time, you're like, no, chances are you're going to do a little mental warfare. You're going to be like, dude, no. That would be completely contrary to who I am, and it'd be leading me down a path that God says is not good for me. Or maybe you're like, you're bored, and you're lonely, and you're like, I don't know, maybe I'm going to deal with that by going to a strip club, you know? There's a thought. But again, chances are, hopefully you're going to wage war with that thought in your mind. You're going to be like, no, dude, that's not who I am, and that's going to take me down a path that's contrary to what God wants for me. And I'm contending that when these thoughts pop into our minds about one another, again, we need to get in the habit of waging war and not just letting them sit there and passively be like, yeah, that's right, I'm not like that. So one of our senior pastors here, Dennis McCallum, and this got mentioned at one point in the evenings. He wrote this book, Satan and His Kingdom. And I think it's the best book that's out there dealing with Satan. It's extremely exhaustive in terms of his origin, how he operates, all that. It's a great book. And he has a section in here. It's a section called The Arrows of Satan, Accusation. And in there, he kind of lays out suggestions for the proper response to these accusatory thoughts that we might have toward one another. And he says basically there's three options. The first one is, if this thing we're fixated on is something small, the truth is we need to overlook it, right? We're going to talk about that more in a little bit. If it's something that this person has done that's actually hurt us, then we need to forgive them. Again, it seems obvious, but we can get very muddled in this. But that's what needs to be done. Then he says, if it's an area of significant sin, then the question becomes, how are we prepared to help? What is God calling on me right now to do to help my brother or sister who's struggling with this significant area of sin? Contempt or sitting in a posture of judgment is never okay. And I got to say, I'm pretty comfortable. I find myself from time to time just automatically just going to a place of judgment. And the truth is, that is never, ever okay. So, again, to summarize this point, I argue that if we're going to preserve the unity in our groups, we need to learn to wage war mentally, right? We need to be willing to take a stand against our flesh and put it to death in this regard. And again, here's the thing. Division, especially the beginnings of division, I think is so dangerous because it's so subtle. And when it comes to our thought life, you know, what we're thinking about other people in our groups, nobody knows that. Nobody can see that. It's so easy for it, again, to just be, to fly under the radar, and it can seem so benign. And yet, I'm going to argue it really could make or break our unity. It's super important. And I just want to say, and we'll talk about this again, I think, at the very end. We had a time of question and answer yesterday where somebody asked to talk about this more. I think that because this is true, that when we are struggling in our thought life about a brother or sister in our group, we really, really need to be careful who we share that with. We really need to be careful about that. You know, there's been this opioid epidemic, right? And recently, there's been a whole lot of talk. It's not just the opioids, it's the fentanyl, right, that's actually killing people. Yeah, I don't know how exaggerated it is or not, but, you know, there have been reports of just the first responders being exposed to a puff of fentanyl is enough to put them in the ER. We need to think about these thoughts that way, right? That this is dangerous. There's times where we need to find someone that's a mature believer that we can share this with, and we'll talk about that. But we need to be careful. I bet you can think of times, even if you just take a minute, when someone has said something to you about a brother or sister that has stuck. It's kind of poisoned you. And I think if we're honest, we can probably think about times when we've done that as well. And I would just add another point of caution. When it comes to people God's put in your life in position of authority, we need to be extra, extra careful about how we talk about that. I think I've noticed in my own life, just the devil just is able to use that in a very powerful way. So we need to be very, very careful when it comes to our negative thought life. All right. So preserving the unity, we're going to take our thought life about each other very, very seriously. That's the first point. The second point is when it comes to preserving the unity is we're going to practice forbearance with one another. We're going to practice forbearance. Last year I did a breakout session on forbearance in marriage. And forbearance in marriage is real important, but the truth is that forbearance is super important in any lasting relationship. It's going to be critical. It is like the infrastructure of a good relationship, a relationship that's going to be more than temporary. You can't have a lasting relationship without this, right? And again, I feel like this is something that's not very glamorous, doesn't get a lot of press, but it's super, super important. When you look up in the Bible dictionary or whatever, the definition of forbearance, they'll say it's synonymous with patience and long-suffering. And it actually can mean self-restraint in the face of provocation. Self-restraint. And what I think is interesting is when you consider how God describes himself in the Old Testament especially. Yeah, he describes himself as the creator. He describes himself as being sovereign. But more often than not, he describes himself this way. I am the God who is slow to anger, right? I am patient. And I think it speaks of his relational character. Anyway, if God is like that, is this how God treats us, right? Then it makes sense that as his image bearers, he's going to call on us to deal with each other this way as well. So in the New Testament, in Colossians, for instance, it says, make allowance for each other's faults, not focus on, not nitpick, not make a big freaking deal about each other's faults. And forgive anyone who offends you. Remember, the Lord forgave you, so you must forgive others. And again, we laugh. The truth is, we think about our super close, or maybe our longest relationships, and we're like, dang, I'm so, so glad that those guys treat me that way. You know, that they know, in my case, how amazingly negative I am and how sarcastic I am and whatever. And yet, they tend to overlook that. And they love me. They don't focus on that. They love me in spite of that. We love that. But again, we think about practicing this in our own lives. We know, man, this is pretty difficult, if not sometimes downright impossible, in those relationships that we're in on a day-to-day, long-term basis, right? Because those relationships that tend to rub on us. But I love this verse in particular because I think not only does Paul talk about the what, but also the how. Because he says, remember, the Lord forgave you. You know, it's like, okay, as you meditate on and really think about what it is God did for you in terms of extending his grace to you, giving you what you didn't deserve, you know, then you're in a position where, you know what, I think I can be generous like that to other people. That he took every sin and he nailed it to the cross and he covered it with his blood for us. That he no longer, he's taken me from a position of being a child of wrath to now being his own child. I mean, like, he's lavished us with this kind of stuff that we don't deserve. As I focus on that and I meditate on that, then it's like, okay, yeah, that's how he treats me. And I'm filled to the brim. I can treat my brothers and sisters that way too. My favorite verse on this is actually in the Old Testament, in Proverbs 19. It says, a man's discretion makes him slow to anger, and it's his glory to overlook an offense. I love that because it's like, okay, so being the sin police or being, you know, like a taskmaster that's completely impossible to please, that isn't to my glory. But it's my glory to overlook a transgression because, again, that's the way God is. When we do that with each other, then in some small way, we're reflecting what he's like. So forbearance is a big, big deal. You know, and again, you're like, maybe I get it. And again, I don't need to tell you the opposite is being easily annoyed. But here's what I want to argue this morning, that it may seem like a small thing, getting annoyed, and what could be more common than, you know, like, my God, that person says like every other word when they speak. It's just like, it's like real annoying, you know. What could be more common than being annoyed? But here's the thing. I think that again, maybe unwittingly, we can play into the hand of the devil when it comes to this, when we end up assigning motive. That's when it gets to be something that can take us down this path that we don't want to go. So we're annoyed. Again, you think of that person in your group. Maybe you don't have one like this, but somebody, you know, it's like that person just talks and talks and talks. And you're like, that's annoying, right? You know, but then you're like, you know what? It's not just that they talk, but I think they really love to hear themselves talking. I think they really value their own opinion. And not only that, but I think, truthfully, they really value their opinion over everyone else's, especially mine, possibly, right? You know, so now it's moved from just being annoyed to being suspicious. And then you're like, you know what? Hi, that person is that way. And not only are they, you know, do they just like to listen to themselves, they don't care to hear what other people hear. I think that they really don't value me or anybody else in the group. And you know what? They're so selfish. I just don't trust that person. So you see how it's gone from something very benign, it's just maybe unwittingly under the radar moved in this direction of distrust. It can do damage. And again, it can be just that little wedge that all the devil needs to plant seeds of division. And I think we need to be on our guard against it. Here's the truth. No matter how well we think we know the person, the truth is that we don't know their motive. You know, I teach this over and over in my marriage class. You know, you can be married 50 years. You might know. You could ask. But you don't know, because motive is something only God knows. And this is what Paul is reminding the Corinthians about. It's actually in a good, it's a good framework that he's talking about here, but it's God's business. He says, therefore, don't go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will bring both to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, and then each man's praise will come to him from God. The Lord discloses the motives of men's hearts, not us. So we want to be aware of that. Again, we want to take ourselves in hand so that we can extend that acceptance to other brothers and sisters. But additionally, I think we can practice forbearance in some other ways. And I kind of thought about, okay, how does this work in terms of God forbearing with us? So how does God forbear with us? He sympathizes with our weaknesses. It says in Hebrews 4, we don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who's been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. I don't completely understand this. Jesus was without sin, but the NLT says he understands our weaknesses. It's really a pretty amazing thing. I don't completely understand it, but I do understand it to mean that he's not annoyed with, and he's not overly focused on my quirks or your character weaknesses. He's just not. And somehow he sympathizes to that. So I think for us, okay, how can I then use this in a way to build unity in my group? And this is kind of counterintuitive. I think we can, on a regular basis, pray about an accurate assessment of our own quirks. And you're like, okay, how does that work? Well, it works like this. It's like when I am more fully aware of how hard it is to live with me, I'm serious, then it gives me more motivation, right, to not make a big deal about these little things that the people around me have that are rubbing me the wrong way. It's like, especially at my age, it's like, yeah, the last thing I want to do is get in front of a mirror with a lot of light. Yet it can be very instructive, right? Painful in the short term, it can be very instructive. And that's what we're asking here. Lord, please, when I find myself being overly sensitive to these things, please, we need to get sensitized to, and we also need the Lord to help us with that so that we can then have that same attitude toward others. God forbears with us. It says that he advocates for us. My little children, I'm writing these things so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. I do not understand this completely. Because I know that my sin's completely covered and it's not an issue. And yet it says that in some way, Jesus stands before the Father and he advocates for me, right? There's mystery here. But I think one very practical way we can apply this when it comes to each other is to begin to pray for each other in these areas of character weakness, things they struggle with, to pray for them that way. That can go such a long way in terms of preserving the unity. I had a chance to teach this back in February, and for once I actually took a little dose of my own medicine, and so since February, I've been pretty regularly praying for my leadership team along these lines. You know, this person worries a lot. This person struggles with discontentment, whatever. But rather than, again, being analytical and thinking about them that way and judging them, I've been intentional about praying for them. I don't have a way of measuring to see how much my prayer life has actually changed those things that they struggle with, but I know this for a fact. My heart is knit so much closer to those guys than it was before. So pray about those weaknesses. And the last thing is, he forbears with us. He helps us. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper that he may be with you forever, right? So here's how I think that this, the Holy Spirit brings what's needed. He comes alongside of us in a lot of different ways. He comforts, he strengthens. Whatever is needed is what he brings. find ways to use your strengths where this person that you're focused on is weak, right? With this eye to the fact that it's God that brought our groups together. You know, sometimes we're just like, oh my gosh, you know, this group, right? I've heard people describe their groups as the island of misfit toys, right? It's just like, probably we're all pretty broken. And yet if God is sovereign, then we can conclude that he's the one that brought us together. And if that's true, then he wants to use our strengths to come alongside where our brothers and sisters are weak. So you're like, you know, focused on this person in your group. You know, they're so disorganized, right? My God, they're always late. They can never remember to bring their Bible, whatever. You're just focused on that, let's just say. You know, rather than sitting in that spot of judgment, especially I'm guessing if you're sensitive to that, chances are that you're not a disorganized person. How about you looking for ways that you can come alongside of them? So when they're the one that signs up, right, to head up the potluck or whatever, you're the next one to sign up, knowing that you can, when they show up with the soup and no spoons, you can be there with the spoons, knowing that you can help them, right? God brought us together. Let's find ways that we can bring our strengths to bear in a way that glorifies him. Okay, so again, to recap. We're going to preserve the unity in our groups. We're going to take our flesh seriously. We're going to not make provision for it, and we're going to stand against it when it comes to our thought life. We are going to find ways to forbear with one another. We're going to deal with this idea of assigning motive, and we're going to find ways to proactively move toward our brothers and sisters with forbearance. And then this last way is that we're going to humble ourselves when it comes to each other in the body of Christ. You don't have to be a rocket scientist, right, to realize how far humility could go to building up the unity in your group. It's pretty obvious. You think about the evil one and what drove his rebellion. Really, what was at the heart of the evil one was pride. And when we exercise humility, I would argue that, man, we are taking a stand against his tactics. We're leaning against what he's all about. And if he is all about pride, we know that Jesus was exactly the opposite, that Jesus, we're told, embodied humility. You know, how did he describe himself in Matthew 11? He says, I'm gentle and I'm humble in heart. That's who our Lord is. And you think about, okay, how low was Jesus willing to go? You know, Paul tries to describe this as best he can there in that famous passage in Philippians 2 where he says, he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, going all the way to the cross to be hung as a common criminal and to be impaled on that cross by the very creatures he created. You know, I think meditating on the humility of Christ, it could probably go a long way in terms of preserving the unity in our groups. I love this book, The Incomparable Christ. It's dated now. Some of the language is difficult. But his insight into who Jesus was is just staggering. And I love what he has to say about the humility of Jesus. He says, nowhere was his humility more strikingly displayed than in the way in which he bore insult and injury. During his brief years of ministry, almost every form of trial assailed him. A dozen times plots were laid against his life. What would be the attitude of a modern dictator to a would-be assassin? They said he was demon-possessed. They said he was mad. They slandered him as a glutton and a drunkard. They impugned his motives and cast aspersions on his character. But all those combined failed to elicit one drop of bitterness or draw forth one word of complaint or self-justification from his lips. He was as a sheep before her shearers, dumb. This is who we follow. And if we're going to follow him, then humility is going to be a huge part of what we're focused on. And I think, again, we can see where it go a long, long way. I think it's interesting, right? So much of what's at the heart of division is selfish ambition, selfish jealousy. And one of the things that turns that on its head is humility. It's also interesting to realize that humility is not a fruit of the Spirit. You could probably argue that maybe a couple of those combined lead to humility, and certainly God wants to work humility into our character, but it's not listed there. It is something, though, that we are commanded to do. So, you know, there are these verbs that come up in connection to humility. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another. We're told to do this. It's interesting. We want to ignore that word completely. How many people in here can say, yeah, I've attained that. I'm completely humble. Peter says, all of you clothe yourself with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Again, Paul says, so those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. We're told to do this because I would again say that our default is far from humility. Our default is pride. And so in order for us to lean against it, we have to make a decision to choose to go the direction of humility. And the scriptures, in several places, they use the analogy of putting on, right? Putting on. And these guys, The Prideful Soul's Guide to Humility, man, this is a great book. A really great book. If you need a good butt kicking, you get one on every page of this book. It's worth every penny. I was shocked. I just looked on Monday to see. It was written in 1998. I was thinking, dang, think how humble I would be if I had read that 20 years ago. It would be awesome. It's a great book. But in their chapter, they have a chapter on the pursuit of humility. And this is what they say in terms of, they say, look, be intentional to do this, because if you're not, you're going to go out into the world every day naked spiritually. And naked's never good, right? So he says, do these things. First of all, put on sackcloth. And he uses this from Nehemiah. You know, in the Old Testament, you put on this special kind of material, and it was to demonstrate to those around you that you were really contrite and broken over your sin, right? Sackcloth. And I don't know if you've noticed, but in the bookstore, we have both sackcloth shirts and skirts, and they're on sale right now. So that'd be awesome, right? Quick fix. Let me put this thing on and I'm done, right? Now, I think for us, the application is, if we're going to be humble, it means an awareness of and honesty about our own sin. It's all too frequent and all too tragic to hear about these really public Christian figures, right, who get taken down in some kind of scandal where their reputation, and worse, the reputation of Christ, is just dragged through the dirt. Sexual, usually, or financial, or whatever. And you just can't help but wonder. I wonder how much of this could have been avoided if they practiced on a regular basis this idea of being aware of their own weaknesses, but more importantly, being honest about that. But the truth is, there's a repugnance inside of us to do this. I've been a believer like 40 years, and I still, there's pushback. I find pushback in my heart when it comes to being honest this way. So I teach a class in our church periodically on marriage, and this last time I taught it, 3 weeks go by, it's a five-week class, and I am horrible at home. I'm horrible. I'm mean. I'm super accusatory. I'm wanting to pick fights right and left, and the more embarrassing truth is, as I'm doing this, I'm accusing my husband of doing these things, which was not true. I mean, it was gross, right? So, you know, and I'm standing up here teaching the class. So the third week of class, I just like, I'm starting class off. I'm like, I don't know how you guys are doing, but I got to be honest. I just feel like I can't get up here and not be honest with you guys. I just want to tell you that's what's going on. So then there's like crickets in the room. Nobody says anything. Then I was like, okay, Lord, I felt like I was being, I was obedient to your conviction. Anyway, we do these exit surveys, and at the end, sure enough, more than one person was like, the best thing in the class was that I was honest about my struggle. But there's pushback, and if we're going to be humble ourselves, we're going to train ourselves to get in the habit of this and push against our flesh. We're going to put on the garments of salvation. What is this? I think for us, it means an ongoing appreciation of receiving what we did not deserve and what we could not do on our own. I was thinking, I don't know how many of you guys have drawn the connection between what happened to those kids in Thailand and us, right? So the whole world was watching. It was so dramatic because these kids were completely helpless to deal with their situation. Completely helpless. And the situation was so dire that they were going to die if they weren't rescued, right? And it's cool, so wonderful how it worked out. But I was just like, dang, that is each one of us. Completely helpless, completely unable to solve the situation we were in terms of where we were at with God. Children of wrath, destined for judgment. And yet God came and rescued each one of us, gave us what we didn't deserve. That's what we should be focused on. In addition, you know, focused on the fact that it's not just that he forgave us then when we first received God's forgiveness, but he continues to deal with us with grace, even though we continue to be sinners. In 1 Timothy 1:15, most of you guys know that's where Paul says, Jesus came into the world to save sinners among whom I am foremost of all. This wasn't written right after he met Christ, you know, where he was just freshly done with killing Christians. This was at the end of his life. And he's like, I am foremost of all. And you can bet having that kind of appreciation of God's grace to him now, it ushered in a humble attitude, you know, when he was dealing with other people. So that's going to go a real long way. They talk about putting on the towel of the servant. That's obvious, right? And this towel of the servant is where we're willing to serve in menial, practical ways the people in our group. Just like Jesus. How low are you willing to go? He's willing to wash their feet. So the question is, what tasks in your group are you not willing to do? And I have to be honest, for me, as I was thinking about that, I was like, not tasks so much. There are certain people in our group that I'm not willing to engage with because I feel like they're beneath me. What is that? That's pride. What tasks aren't you willing to do? Or maybe, what practical need of a person in your group have you met? Not in the last week, because I thought, that's not fair. I can't ask that. Not in the last month. That still might not be enough time. But how about in the last quarter? And you're like, nah, I don't think there's been that many practical needs in my group in the last quarter. Chances are you're missing something here. Or maybe you're like, I'm just so busy. There's no way I could be the one to show up to help that person move or to offer to babysit or to help clean or to take a meal. I get it. We're all real busy. But what I find is when I am sensitive to this and head in this direction, God always provides the time and the energy. It's pretty amazing. I have a friend who's probably the busiest person I know in our church. Has the highest capacity of just about anybody I know, who does more than anybody I know. And she's the first one to bring a meal. She's literally the first one to clean a bathroom. She's been known to cut people's toenails. I don't know how much lower you can go than that. Yeah, that goes a long way in building humility into us. Others of us, it's like, I'm pretty good at doing that, but not so cool about letting other people in on my needs. So, again, can you answer that question? You're like, yeah, well, I'm not in a season of need right now. You will be. And the question is, are you going to allow people to serve you? And the last way these guys say that we can dress ourselves with humility is to put on the clothing of the groomsmen. And this is from John 3. This is John the Baptist, and he says, you know, this is how it should be for me. This is how it is for me and Jesus. I'm like the groomsman who rejoices to hear the voice of the groom. And apparently the custom in that day was, during this wedding feast, they'd actually have like a bridal chamber set up there. And I guess the marriage was consummated there in the bridal chamber. And I guess at some point the groom would let everyone know, you know, I don't know if it was like a hip hip hooray or a Yahoo or OHIO, I don't know. But the groomsmen, because they loved their friend and they were so happy for their friend, they rejoiced to hear the groom's voice. And that's where he says, Jesus must be get bigger and I must get smaller. And I think for us it means desiring and furthering the success of those in our group. You know, not being focused on our own success and our own progress, but like I'm riveted on and I'm concerned about the success of those in my group. And I think very practically it can amount to being the first to notice and acknowledge when they've taken ground. Gary likes to talk about good gossip. So not only did I notice that in my group that even though you're a very shy person and you're very reluctant to talk to people that you don't know, you went over and you greeted that brand new person who's never been here before. And you hung in there and you talked to them for a length of time. Not only am I going to mention that to you, but I'm going to gossip about it to people in my cell group. Right? We should be the first ones to acknowledge that and to make a big deal about that. Again, what keeps us from doing that last times? It's our pride. I was in group with Bev and Gary for like 7 years recently. And Gary DeLashman, who's one of our senior pastors, as gifted a teacher as anyone I've ever met, was on the regular teaching rotation. And so sure enough, you know, we come to home church, he'd teach, and I'd have that thought, man, that was a great teaching. I should tell him, man, it was a great teaching. But then I'd have that other thought, nah, this is what he does all the time. He already knows he's a great teacher, right? What is that? It's my pride pushing back. Oh, no, I needed to tell him that. You see what I'm saying? So we should be the first ones to do that. So these are ways for us to put on, very practical ways for us to put on humility. Why? Because as we put on humility, I contend we thwart one of the main tactics of the evil one, and it's going to just really enhance the oneness in our groups. So just another quick, I don't know, word of caution maybe, or just a sidebar, and we don't have time to talk about that now, but the question comes up, what if you're stuck and you cannot get your heart right when it comes to somebody in your group? What happens then? And honestly, this does happen, right? Let's be real. You know, I'd say one thing is you need to check and get before the Lord and make sure you've forgiven that person. Lots of times some of us can be out of touch with that. We need to allow God to search us, and then we need to forgive them. With forgiveness, lots of times comes clarity. So that's a very basic but important step. We need to get input from mature believers. I talked about that a little earlier. And somebody asked in the other group, can you talk about that more? I mean, we need to lean against the tendency of going to someone who's just going to be an ally with us. When I was a new believer, I was super intimidated by home group. And I was uncomfortable. I just have all this social anxiety. So not only did I not go to home group a lot, my husband went, God bless him, but I stayed home. I found another discontented person in that group that I would often get together with. And she and I would just spend the evening bad-mouthing people in the group, right? Some of it was probably legitimate, the stuff that we picked up on. But what were we doing there? I was finding an ally, right, to be down with my sinful assessment of other people. That is not helpful. What we need is to find somebody who's mature, hopefully somebody that knows how we roll and will be willing to speak to that. But at a minimum, we can get them to at least enter in with us to pray about this situation. So if we're stuck, that can be helpful. And I know people who've gotten to the point in these situations where it's like, you know, I've worked through all these things. I cannot dislodge this attitude in my heart. And so what they've done is they've actually gone to their brother and sister, not as a way to secretly, passively, aggressively punish them, but to be like, I got to confess that I, for the last month or whatever, man, I've had an attitude about you, and I'm just sorry, and I want to ask for your forgiveness. And it can take something that dramatic every now and then. And what that does is it turns the evil one's tactics on its head. What's the devil counting on is that attitude in your heart blooming and growing and working toward division. And instead, lots of times, that kind of humility of saying, I need to ask for your forgiveness, that can knit you together to that brother or sister like you'd never been knit before. So we're going to fight the fight. We're not going to just passively let these thoughts just sluice around in our hearts and minds. We're going to kill our flesh in this regard. We're going to find ways to practice forbearance with each other, and we're going to look for ways to humble ourselves when it comes to our brothers and sisters in our group. I think practicing any one of these with some kind of intentionality will go a long way, right, to enhance the unity in our groups. Well, I'm going to pray. So, Lord, just thanks so much for your patience toward us. And we're just super grateful, Lord, for the chance to have real, lasting, loving relationships. It's a blessing that we don't deserve. And just help us to find one thing that we can practice going forward that's really going to help us to be really focused on preserving this great thing that you've given us. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.